This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Storytelling has always been an important part of Dr. Raymond Barfield's life. As a child, Ray loved to sit down and listen to his grandfather tell tales. When he studied philosophy in college, he found that his favorite philosophers were the ones who could illustrate their ideas with stories. And even now, as a pediatric oncologist and a professor of Christian philosophy at Duke Divinity School, he finds himself drawn to stories. So you shouldn't be surprised that Raymond Barfield has decided to become a novelist. His debut novel is titled The Book of Colors. He's going to be reading tonight at 7 o'clock at Raleigh's Quail Ridge Books. But first, he is here with us on The State of Things. Welcome, Ray. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Tell us about those early days listening to stories, especially grandfather stories in particular, I guess. Huh?
Yeah. Well, my grandfather, he was a wonderful guy. I had an eighth grade education, climbed power line poles for Georgia Power Company. But he could tell a story with a kind of eloquence that I've never heard matched. He was amazing to listen to.
I mean, did you think about as a young man, just sort of riveted by your grandfather's stories, it's one thing to be kind of consuming them, but were you sort of thinking about this artifact, this thing he's got, the story?
Yeah, well, it showed up later. It showed up when I was a teenager. Most of the stories that I started listening to, I was a little kid, so I didn't even have a concept of story. I just listened to Once Upon a Time and everything that followed. But what he taught me is how deeply his stories were connected to physical places and to the particulars of individual people. That's the reason his stories were so interesting.
When did you start writing?
I started writing in college. I guess you'd call it writing. But I didn't start writing every day with the intention of actually learning how to do it until I hit medical school.
Why in medical school? I mean, by then I think you've got a career pretty well in mind. You're going to be a doctor.
Yes, but writing didn't feel so much like a career move.
Well, there you
writing
go.
Was a way to save a part of my mind that felt like it was being, like it was drying up in medical school.
What kind of things were you writing about then?
Well, while I was in medical school, I wrote 9 very awful short novels. And I had a novel about a homeless guy, a novel about a grave robber who worked for a medical school. And they were awful. I can't even read them myself.
Did you think, were you writing prose at first or poetry? What kind of writing were you first attracted to?
No, I started out writing prose.
Yeah.
And then as I began to realize that I was falling in love with language, I started to move towards poetry. And poetry was one of the places where it was a school for me. And I moved from poetry. I don't write a whole lot of poetry right now. I'm working on one long poem called Dante's New Moon. But most of what I write is prose now. But it's prose written by a guy schooled in poetry.
Well, now you've got a published novel, The Book of Colors. So those 12 bad novels paid off.
They did.
Ibsen said you've got to write a bad play before you write a good one. You've written 12 bad novels, so you're on your way to a career.
I'm ambitious.
Tell us about The Book of Colors.
So The Book of Colors it came about in a way that nothing else I've ever written came about, because it came about without me having any idea what it was going to be. I didn't even know who the characters were going to be. The first chapter brings up a character named Rose, and when I titled the chapter, I thought it was literally going to be a rose, and it wasn't until it started speaking that I realized it was a person and not a flower.
Well, tell us about the characters in this book and give us a little bit of the plot and the action in the book.
Well, the central character is a 19-year-old African-American pregnant homeless girl. So sometimes even I'm surprised by the fact that she showed up, especially showed up speaking in her own voice, since I'm an overeducated middle-aged white guy. But she drives the story more than plot, because her character is so beautiful. She's one of the most beautiful souls I've ever encountered. And she emerges from a circumstance that to many people would look hopeless. But she shows us that there isn't a circumstance that by itself qualifies as hopeless, including hers.
Did you? You must have had some encounter with Rose, even though this is not your life. Mm-hmm. How did you meet her, or a character who informed her?
So the two characters, Islaya and Rose. Rose is the older lady. Both of them are characters that I met through hospital experience, because the hospital was the cauldron that got me out of my my teenage suburban environment. In the hospital, everybody shows up because everybody gets sick. So I met Rose, or the character that comes to my mind when I think of Rose, on a hospital ward at Grady Memorial Hospital. And I met Islaya, who's the main character, the teenage girl. I met her in emergency rooms at Grady at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning over and over again.
Will you read for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This is from a chapter called The Magazine Rack. You'd be surprised at how much work it is to be poor. Nothing gives way to what you want. The winter is cold, and you feel what that means. Summer is hot. Rain means your bed might get wet. Your clothes are thin, and you know what it might be like to not have any clothes. There ain't nothing to steal, but people steal anyway because it's easy to steal from the poor. When we sat out on the porch and watched the train, sometimes we were just getting over the work of being poor. Church was the only beautiful thing in my life, and the baby that was growing inside me, and the jigsaw puzzle of Paris, and the raccoon bones, and some other things, I suppose. I haven't decided if a thing being beautiful is an idea or a feeling. I don't always feel very much that I know of. I've known people who cry and laugh and rage, and they live their lives always doing one or the other of those things. But I know my baby got its stillness from me. I hardly feel anything at all sometimes. I do what's next. And that's the way the poor get their work done. That's the secret. But every now and then, no matter how poor I was, I wanted to see something besides the house and Rose, Layla, Jimmy, and Ambrosia. I wanted to be alone, even though I was carrying around somebody. So I'd take a bath to make sure I smelled good, and then I'd go to the bookstore. Except for bus fare on the nights when Jimmy wouldn't drive me in his old nasty brown Chevy, it didn't cost anything. I'd go to the bookstore to see the magazine rack. It goes on, and there are always people scattered along it looking at something. I can spend a whole Saturday night looking at magazines. It's a time I feel least, and so I am the happiest. Almost everything I look at on the rack has to do with something besides me. I even sleep better, knowing there's so much going on in the world besides me. When I'm at the magazine rack, I can't tell how many hours go by. There's so many things to look at, and I have to breathe to keep myself looking at one at a time and not grabbing a bunch and seeming to cause trouble and getting thrown out. I've never once been thrown out.
It's Raymond Barfield reading from his debut novel, The Book of Colors. He's going to be reading at Quail Ridge Books tonight at 7 o'clock. My guest today on The State of Things is Leah. The father of her baby is a fairly despicable character who we don't like very much at all. But you talk about, and their circumstances, again, this neighborhood where they're living is a desperate place. And again, you talked about your background not being any of that. Mm-hmm. The characters you may have met in the hospital, how did you know about their place?
The only way to know about their place is to listen to their stories. And the only way to listen to their stories is to stop talking. And that's a hard thing to do as a doctor.
They say, you know, the first advice you hear young writers get is write what you know. You have secondhand experience of these folks. They come up alive in the book. First of all, the question is, why didn't you write what you know? Why didn't you write about your personal experience?
Well, the experience of writing this book was mostly getting out of the way. And when I started writing this book, I remember the morning that I started writing this book. And the morning I started writing it, the only thing that showed up were 50 titles. And so I just wrote down 50 titles. And the next morning, I grabbed the first title that caught my eye, And I wrote for an hour before I went to the bone marrow transplant unit to start doing my job. And to be honest, this is just the voice that showed up. It wasn't a white doctor. It was this Leia.
After writing these, essentially, and did they became the chapter titles, or mm-hmm. some of them did.
They right? did, yeah.
In these books. You put the characters together and you talk about the in this book. And again, their circumstances are distressing, but there is a ray of hope. There is a relationship, a kind of family that they become that that maybe you didn't recognize growing up. It wouldn't have looked like family to you or me. But it does. It emerges as family in this book.
Yeah,
did that again emerge for you, or was that something that you had heard your experience in the ER, your sense that? Because I would think that that's the most desperate place in the world. Those are people who are victims of some of the most horrific things in the world, and people are moving fast. They don't have time to hear all the backstory. And any sense that these people come from any kind of loving environment, in the cases of people who are really desperately poor, those people who show up at the hospital.
Well, I'll tell you, I have two girls in my mind right now, images from the early 90s when I was in the emergency room, and I can see them as clear as day. And the girl that needed treatment was afraid. It was her first time in the emergency room, 3 o'clock in the morning. And the girl that was accompanying her had been there before, and so she sort of knew the way that it goes. And she explained what I was going to do, and she held her hand, and she made her laugh. And then they figured out that I was also laughing and that I wasn't going to be a scary doctor and I wasn't going to do anything without explaining it and without being respectful. And we began to talk. And the stunning thing to me is that these girls who were in their, one of them was in their mid-teens, one of them was in their late teens, the resources that these girls had to have to help each other and to show up and to actually take care of a problem that would have never crossed my mind when I was their age, stunned me. It had to come from somewhere. I mean, that strength had to come from somewhere.
You are very serious about the idea that physicians should spend more time listening to stories, mm-hmm. that narrative is critical to healing. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about that.
Well, one of the illusions in medicine is that the point of the whole thing is what medicine does. And it's not. I mean, medicine is a servant. Beginning, middle, and end. The drugs, the scalpels, the shiny buildings, every bit of it is in service to something else. It's not the point. And the thing that it's in service to is the story of the individuals who come in with illness, with their suffering, maybe facing their own death, which is the end of their story. And if we don't listen to the stories, we lose the point of why we're doing this in the first place. It just becomes a biological experiment. Those of us who are physicians, if we wanted to be biologists, could have gone and done PhDs in biology, but we didn't. We got our MDs and became physicians because we wanted to stand in the gap with individual human beings who show up and then take whatever it is that we know of science and give it to them. Put it to their service. But it's in service to their story. Their story tells us the why. It tells us the point of the whole thing. And very often, especially towards the end of life, decisions cannot be made apart from understanding what the person's story is. And if decisions are made just in response to biology, they're disastrous. And it's part of the reason why half the intensive care unit beds in this country are filled with people who probably would rather not be there, would rather be in a different place. But no one ever asked them about their story.
Yeah, but I can imagine a bunch of people who decided rather than be biologists, they would be MDs and who've been practicing for a while saying, you know, Dr. Barfield, I hear what you're saying, and we don't have time for that. Mm-hmm. We don't have time for that.
And there's a sense in which as the culture cramps down on the amount of time that you're allowed to spend with a patient, and as the physicians are evaluated based on revenue generation, that's a fair argument. But one of the things that I've discovered is if I'm talking to a group of physicians or physicians in training, and one of them asks about time and says, we just don't have time, I'll stop and I'll say, let me show you what 30 seconds feels like, or what 60 seconds feels like, or what 2 minutes feels like. And I just won't say anything. Do you feel that?
We can't run that experiment here.
You can't run that experiment. So I just gave you a 4 second pause.
Yeah.
And it immediately made you uncomfortable.
Sure did.
And it made everyone who's listening to this radio show uncomfortable because they thought, wait, that's a pause. It's silence. And yet that 4 seconds is probably the thing that everyone's going to remember from this conversation. And so if we extend that to the unimaginably long 2 minutes of not saying anything, wow, a lot of storytelling can be done and a whole lot of things can happen in that 2 minutes. So I don't buy the argument that there's not time.
What about two? I mean, it is striking to me the number of people I've heard in the medical profession talk about the power of story and listening to people and how much healing has gone on in just the brief process of listening to a story. Mm-hmm. The number of times I've heard practitioners, nurses and doctors talk about someone coming in, spilling the whole story. They came in with a battery of complaints and left saying, you know, I feel better. Mm-hmm. It would seem to me that that should inform the profession, but I wonder to what extent, you know, we have the incentives in the wrong places. In other words, if healing were if it were incentivized, you get paid for each healing rather than each procedure, maybe more we pay more attention to those anecdotes from physicians who've noticed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And there's one place, you know, something about death that changes everything. And so the end of life cauldron, that arena, is a place where experiments are done that aren't done elsewhere. And this is one of the experiments that's being done there. So if you remember back to when the Affordable Care Act was being debated, and there was all of the kerfluffle around President Obama walking into the intensive care unit and turning off your grandmother's ventilator, it was related to conversations about death, to a small, non-controversial, bipartisan-supported clause that was put into the ACA about remunerating physicians for taking time to talk at the end of life about what the options actually look like. And we've gotten past a lot of that dust storm. It failed a second time a year after it was first introduced, but now people are talking about it again. And it may actually open up a space for us to do an experiment in stories of sorts, where that becomes a formal part of how we approach people at the end of their life. I think it'll make a lot of difference. And once we learn in the cauldron of end-of-life care the power that stories can have in decision-making, then I think that that's an opening to extend it to the rest of medicine.
Did your book, this novel, The Book of Colors, inform your medical practice at all? Did you change the way you see things after having written this book?
One of the biggest things that it changed is that it showed me the power of a very small amount of listening. Because the girls that I mentioned before that are in my mind when I think of Islaya, I had no more than 10 or 15 minutes with them. And yet they had an impact big enough to inform the voice of this character for the whole novel. So in that sense, yeah, it definitely affected my practice because it taught me the power of a voice listened to even for a small amount of time.
We appreciate the time you spent with us. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Dr. Raymond Barfield is a professor of Christian philosophy at Duke Divinity School and a pediatric oncologist and the author of The Book of Colors. He's going to be reading from The Book of Colors tonight, 7 o'clock, Raleigh's Quail Ridge Books. Just ahead, two hip-hop artists from Chapel Hill talk about the town's legacy in the hip-hop scene, and we'll get a preview of the Hillmatic Festival after this.